continue from what I was talking about the other day. I'm talking about the five hindrances, and in particular, emphasizing around the sense of wise attention and unwise attention, and the importance of where we're placing our attention, what we're paying attention to, how we're paying attention, in the sense of using wisdom or not. So that it's quite important to pay close attention to how you do pay attention, because it's such a common function of the mind that we don't really recognize very clearly how it's being used, or we end up being caught in our own sort of forms of logic and our own preferences and biases without realizing it. There's an old story which is rather good to illustrate that. And there's an old hermit living in the forest practicing Buddhism, and he was living in the forest on his own, and had a vegetable garden, and used to look after himself and do his own practice. And he had a band of monkeys who used to come around, and he used to look after them, and they had quite good relations. He was a very kind sort of hermit, and they were rather well behaved monkeys, so everybody got along happily. And then the hermit was going to go off to a meeting of hermit convention, and went away was going to go away for a period of time. So he asked the monkeys to look after his garden for him, to water the plants, and so they said, "Oh, of course, certainly, we'll look after the plants for you, we'll water them every day." And then they did. They started really, the hermit went off, and then the leader of the monkeys got the other monkeys together, and they're going around watering all the plants and being very diligent. And then the head of the monkeys sort of said, This is tiring. We're doing all this watering every day. Why don't we find a way to make it a bit easier?" And then the other says, "Well, how do we do that?" And he says, "Well, I've got a plan. What we'll do, there's no point in watering the plants that don't really need it. So that, well, what we'll do is just sort of check the roots, whichever ones have got long roots, and then we'll put more water. If they got short roots, then they don't need so much water." So that's what they did. So they diligently watered and then checked the roots of everyone, put it back, and of course they all died when the hermit came back. So that, and it was a quite a logical theory, but not really wise attention. So that in our practice, and we also have to be careful of how what your attention is doing, what it's leading to, particularly around these five hindrances, because the five hindrances are what are going to create the impetus within the mind for unwholesome dhammas to sustain themselves. And in the same way that, say, wise attention, when you're investigating and around these five hindrances, then it's a source of settling the mind. The unwholesome dhammas will come to ceasing or slow down or be in abeyance, and one will have the opportunity to bring up more wholesome dhammas. So the sense of using those five hindrances to sort of a flashpoint for investigation when you're practicing. Sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness, agitation, and doubt. Are they there? Are they not there? If they're dealt with skillfully, then the mind will settle very easily, quickly. Or one has an opportunity to find out how to still the mind. Allowing the mind to come back to its stillness, its natural stillness. This is where the Buddha compares these five hindrances to different states of water. In the hindrance of sensual desire is like water which has color in it, red color, green color, yellow color, and it turns the mind, turns the water to that particular color. The hindrance of ill will and aversion is like water boiling, and whether there's color in it or whether it's boiling, then one's not able to see one's reflection. It's not, and if water were still and clear, then one would be able to see one's reflection in it. In the same way, the mind. The nature of the mind is this stillness, clearness. One can see oneself. One can see things. One can see the world clearly. See oneself clearly. But when the hindrances are there, then that clarity is lost. The analogy of water, how it changes its state, and then its clarity is lost. The hindrance of sloth and torpor is compared to water that has moss and water plants covering it over. The hindrance of restlessness and agitation is like the water that is blown by wind, so it's the surface is ruffled, the surface is agitated, and then the hindrance of doubt is compared to water which is muddy and turbid, and stirred up. Not only that, it's kept in a dark place as well, so it's unable to to one is unable to see one's reflection. So these are actually very apt similes of the nature of the mind that is overcome by these different hindrances, and how it affects the mind. Ill will and aversion, boiling water, sloth and torpor, just being sort of covered over with slime, restlessness, being sort of ruffled and agitated, water being agitated, doubt is sort of cloudy and turbid and unclear, not able to see anything clearly. So that they, working with the hindrances and working with the mind so that the mind can come back to this quality of still, clear, limpid water, which is able to, one can see things clearly in it. Buddha also talks the hindrances as the hindrance of sensual desire as a person who is in debt, and this is quite apt in terms of the when one is in debt, and one takes out a loan, and say one's happiness is dependent on that loan. It's not dependent on one's own resources. So in a similar way, like sensual, the movement towards sensual desire, the happiness and well-being that we get from the sense objects, is not actually. From our own strength of character, or our own good qualities, or our own clarity of mind, it's the happiness is from it's like a loan. It doesn't belong to us really. And in the same way that if somebody has taken out a loan, then there's always the worry that the person who is given the loan will come to collect the debts. And same way when we can feel that in ourselves, if we are seeking our pleasure and well-being in the world outside around us, It's not our own. It can be taken back from us very, very easily. Relying on sensuality is an unreliable source of well-being. It can change so rapidly. And then also the happiness and well-being of freeing oneself from the hindrance of sense desire is like being able to be settle one's debts, to be free from the loans that one has taken out. The sense of the burden is lifted. There's a sense of well-being and happiness. The hindrance of ill will is like compared to someone who is ill, who has a disease, has a sickness, so that they there's a discomfort because of that illness and sickness, so that Similarly, with the quality of ill will within the mind, it really is like a sickness, like a disease of being ill. Wherever we go, if we're ill, then we're not comfortable. Wherever we go, we're sort of being drained by that illness. So that ill will does exactly the same thing in the mind. Wherever we go, whatever we do, we're sort of being drained by that ill will. That ill will and aversion is making the life and the world around us uncomfortable and unpleasant. So that the freeing oneself from the hindrance of ill will is like the being freed from getting well, recovering from one's illness, being able to go about one's business of living without having this oppressive illness burdening one all the time. So that's a source of well-being and happiness. The hindrance of sloth and torpor is compared to somebody being in jail, in prison, not being free to go about wherever they want, they're sort of incarcerated and the world is going by them while they're sort of held in incarceration. Similarly with sloth and torpor, when the mind is dull and sleepy and just not able to get any effort together, then it's like one is imprisoned in this state of dullness, and the world goes past one, and the time passes, and one is stuck in this state, and one doesn't enjoy or appreciate the world around one because one is missing out on everything because one's stuck in a state of dullness. So that freeing the mind from sloth and torpor, bringing up effort, bringing up the different tools which can brighten the mind and give it some energy. It's like being let out of prison, being able to go where one wants and do what one wants and enjoy the world around one. That's a source of well-being. The quality of the hindrance of restlessness, agitation, is compared to being a slave, not being a free person, being a person who is sort of in bondage to somebody else, something else, that's the way the mind is with restlessness. The slightest thought, the slightest movement of mind, the slightest thing that comes up on the screen inside is one is obligated and compelled to think about it, to proliferate around it, the mind just keeps restlessly moving around it. So it's like one is a slave to the thoughts and impressions in the mind, in the same way that a slave has no recourse to to saying that I'm not going to, I won't do this. I'm going to take a break. I'm going to stop. I'm going to have a rest. They have no recourse to that. And in the same way, our minds, which are overwhelmed by restlessness, we have no recourse. The mind just keeps moving, keeps seeking out, having to. Being compelled to think and proliferate because of various impressions and thoughts and ideas. So that the overcoming of that hindrance is a source of great happiness and well-being, being a free person again, not being a slave. The hindrance of doubt is compared to a merchant who is wealthy, has goods and possessions, but is crossing a wilderness, a desert, where there's much danger and difficulty. So that there's a high level of suffering there, the uncertainty, will they make it, will they not make it, is a doubt about which is the right way to go, what's the proper course to take here, because it's a wilderness that has no markings, a desert that has no trail. The hindrance of doubt is similar, where we get into states of we don't know where we're going, what we're doing, what's the path, what's the way forward, what's the way, what's the correct thing to do, what's the right thing to do, so that the overcoming of doubt is a reaching a place of safety. The merchant who crosses the desert, gets out of the wilderness, comes to a place of safety and is able to rest and to enjoy the fruits of his journey. So in the same way for working with doubt, or freeing the mind from doubt. It's a place of safety, seeing more clearly what is the path, what is not the path, what is wholesome, what is unwholesome, what is conducive to goodness and what is conducive to that things which are inappropriate and improper. So these hindrances. Finding the different ways of skillful means of working with and dealing with and freeing the mind from them. There are many discourses of the Buddhas that talk about it. We've all heard talks on the five hindrances about what different techniques to use. The main thing is what I'm emphasizing is this sense of actually paying close attention to what, when there is a hindrance there and when there's not. When there is wise attention being paid and when there's unwise attention being paid. To the hindrance or the fact that there are no hindrances there. Because sometimes there can be, where there's actually no hindrance, and then by paying unwise attention to that, then we're creating problems around it. So that really turning our attention to how to sustain a quality where the mind is more settled, is more able to not be overwhelmed by these hindrances, and this is a moment to moment practice when we're say like doing Anapanasati, getting a very fine sense on the in breath and the out breath is concentrating the mind by settling the hindrances, not being drawn into the hindrances, not supporting the hindrances. That's where you direct your attention to the quality of mind which is in, you know, say opposition, or is not feeding those hindrances. So the mind will come together. The mind will settle. Concentrating the mind is working with those hindrances, working with the more refined sense of sustaining attention in a wise way. The next section in the sutta is concerning the liberating the mind, freeing the mind, and breathing in, freeing the mind, liberating the mind, breathing out, freeing the mind, liberating the mind. Vimoccha again. Cittanga, the mind which is free, not bound. So that this is where the preparation needs to be made in terms of concentration. There needs to be a foundation in steadiness of mind, and then a preparation in terms of the mind which is able to work and to investigate. So that it can see where it's holding on to things, what it's holding on to, what are the underlying obstructions in the mind. This is where the Buddha is points to attachment. Four forms of attachment are the source of our perpetuating the wheel of existence of suffering. The tendency to recreate suffering is based on the attachment. In the Paticchasamuppada, the tanha, desire, being a condition for attachment. Attachment being the condition for becoming, becoming the condition for birth, and birth the condition for old age, sickness, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair, all the different forms of suffering. So that this upadana, the attachment, is one of your key links in investigation in order to free oneself from the tendency of suffering. So the Buddha delineates four kinds of attachment. Attachment to sensual desire, attachment to views, attachment to rites and rituals, and attachment to self. So then these are very useful themes for investigation and reflection when you're when we're practicing, when we're practicing Anapanasati. Where does the mind turn to? What is it holding on to? What is it clinging to? This is where the Buddha, in one discourse, sort of gives a very short outline of his whole teaching, and say like a summary of his whole teaching. And he says that all dhammas should not be clung to. Sambhaya dhamma nalang apinivesaya. Apinivesaya is like not to be clung to, not to be adhered to, not to be inclined towards. So that, that all dhammas should, all dhammas should not be held on to, clung to, adhered to, grasped after. And if we use that point as a means for investing, one, you start to see where does these patterns of attachment, where do we keep getting stuck? Where does our mind go to? And giving a sense of, and then just this sense of releasing, not clinging to, not holding on to, not grasping. It's like the what we grasp is going to give us pain. It's like grasping onto something hot, a coal, and burning oneself. Grasping onto a knife and cutting oneself with it. Grasping onto the blade and cutting myself with it. Grasping onto a grasping onto a snake, onto a poisonous snake. You grasp the head and you get bitten really quickly. You grasp the tail, you grasp any other part of it, and it's still turning around and biting you. So that the sort of like the head is like the like suffering, and then even the tail, which you grasp, is like grasping onto happiness. Wherever you grab it, you hold on to it. It's still going to come around and bite you one way or the other. So that our grasping onto sense desire, on views and opinions, practices and say rites and rituals, the sense of self, these are all turned around and bite us. And sense desire is quite clear in terms of a grasping, which is a source of suffering. And the views, and this is like holding on to views of, this is right, that's wrong, I'm right, he's wrong, this is the way it has to be, so that it gets into very fixed positions, and you end up separated and in conflict with other people or with the world around one because of views. So that grasping after a view is going to create suffering. In this, the grasping after rites and rituals is not that one doesn't do any kind of practices, or doesn't have any kind of ceremony or ritual, but it's a sense of this particular practice, that ceremony, that ritual will purify me. That's where my purification will come from. And that, if it's just focused on a particular external form of practice, then that's an attachment, that's clinging. Because the Buddha's teaching is always that there needs to be understanding, there needs to be wisdom. One has to see clearly, one has to free the mind from internal defilements. Greed, hatred and delusion need to be cleared from the mind. It's not because of some precepts or some particular practice that one is doing. One does takes on precepts, one takes on practices with wisdom, using it in a particular way so that it's beneficial for the relinquishing of defilements. The attachment to self is not, it's not attachment to self, but the attachment to the appearance of self. Atavadupadana is, it's not the attachment to self, but it's to the doctrine of self, the belief in self, the appearance of self, because what we call self is really a composite of many things coming together, and it creates the illusion of an I, a self, which is stable, fixed, an entity. But in reality, it's an ephemeral feeling which passes. It's a show which is put on, so that to see through that illusion of self, to be able to turn one's attention to the, because our attachment is very solid around sense of self. Notice that, especially when we're in terms of meditation, refining consciousness, we start seeing this sense of self coming out in so many different ways. The whole realm of other desires are sort of propped up around this, the glue of self, or what hold the other attachments together. Sensual desire is usually to prop up our sense of self. Our views are definitely there to keep our sense of self very sort of clear, propped up and solid. Practices and whatnot that we do revolve around the perception of self, how we see ourselves. We do practices to maintain our image of being somehow gained and accomplished. We do things to try to create an image of how we present ourselves to others, so that this whole sense of the appearance of self, the illusion of self, needs to be seen and to relinquish, let go of. And this is because all of these forms of attachment are like carrying a burden. There's a burden which just keeps weighing one down, having the sense of self, trying to get satisfaction from sensuality, trying to prop up a view which ends up creating conflict and opposition with other people in the world around us. The practices which one has the hope that they'll give some form of purity, but they end up stale and not really satisfactory at all. So it's a constant, it's a burden. So that this quality of recognizing the burden of that we carry around, this attachment, what we hold to, what we cling to, and to put attention to just the putting down the burden, setting aside the the burden of our attachment, putting things down. Do that in the meditation. It's just the breathing in, freeing the mind, breathing out, freeing the mind. Recognizing this, the movement toward attachment, just putting the burden down. Just each, on a real moment-to-moment basis, that sense of just putting the burden down. This is suffering, it's heavy. And as we get a sense of having put burden down, there's a lightness that comes into the mind. And the mind is such to have a sense of a space, a bit more freedom in the mind. And this is what this freeing the mind is a way of practicing, using the mindfulness of breathing and using a structure for investigation. Offer that for your reflection this evening.